bones, and I felt an inexplicable urge to brush them off with my fingertips. Instead, I asked him where he was going.
Dee sounded the alarm for one of his meetings. Apparently, Corrandon has done something unforgivable, as the committee sees it. Dee's all set to tie him up and throw him in a cupboard. Kidnapping the governor is at least as reasonable as all of Dee's other ideas. I tried to stay out of it mostly, but today was such a nice day for a drive.
Mud and all?
The mud especially.
His hazel eyes sparked, catching the light for a moment, before he resettled his hat, preparing to leave.
Perhaps I'll see you in town sometime, I told him. I'm not often there anymore. I've recently moved out to Ngong to stay with my good friend, Karen Blixen.
Surely he meant Blix's wife, the mysterious baroness.
Is that right? She's wonderful. Danish. Runs a coffee farm, all on her own, while Blix is off stalking his rhino. I don't know how she pulls it off, but she does.
His voice chimed with obvious admiration.
I imagine you've met Blix. There aren't many pretty women who escape him.
Yes, I smiled. That was my take on him, too. It was hard to know what Dennis was actually saying about the Baroness. Was he living with her, as if they were husband and wife? Or were they merely close companions, as he and Barclay were? There was no way to ask directly, of course.
The farm is so much nicer than town, he went on. And the air is champagne. It's the altitude, I think.
Sounds like something Barclay would say, I remarked.
I suppose it does.
He smiled again.
Come and visit us sometime. We love to have company. And Karen has a small house sitting empty on her property just now. You could stay as long as you like. Come with the story, though, he said, cranking the engine. It's one of our requirements.
A story? I'll have to drum one up, then.
Do that, he said, before he roared away.
Chapter 23. A few weeks later, Dee called me in from the paddock and handed over a telegram addressed to me. I assumed it was a rare bit of news from my father, or perhaps some sort of demand from Jock. But the envelope had a smeared return address from London. Turning away from Dee, I broke the sticky seal with a sharp twinge of dread. Dear Beryl, I read, Harry has died, and the boys and I will return to the colony. Stop. Would you please look for lodgings? We don't know anyone, and money is dear. Stop. Mother. Mother. That word alone felt like a slap. I'd pushed her memory away long ago, as far as I could, but it lurched dizzily to life now. My eyes raced over the few sentences again. My throat was as dry as dust.
Everything all right? Dee asked.
Clara's returning to Kenya, I said numbly.
Good grief! I thought she'd vanished for good.
Apparently not. I handed him the flimsy paper, as if it would explain anything. Who's Harry?
Harry?
He was quiet for a moment, reading, and then he sighed heavily and raked his hands through his hair.
Let's have a nip of brandy, shall we?
It wasn't easy to drag the whole story out of Dee, but the drink worked to pry him open a little, and me as well. After an hour, I had the gist of it. Harry Kirkpatrick was a captain my mother had met in her second year in Kenya, at a dance in Nairobi after a race meeting. Their involvement was meant to be a secret, but those kinds were hard to keep. By the time she left for London with him, Dickie in tow, the scandal had blazed through the colony.
Obviously she married him at some point, Dee said, though I can't say when. We fell completely out of touch.
Why didn't anyone tell me the truth? Dee cupped his brandy glass, thinking, and then said,
It might have been a mistake. Who's to say? Everyone wanted to protect you from the worst of it. Florence was the loudest of all. She insisted it would only make everything worse.
I thought of the day I'd pored over the map of England in Lady Dee's atlas, and her saying she could tell me things about my mother if I wanted to know. Had she planned to invent a tale, a doctored version of the truth? Or had she begun to feel it was time I understood what had really happened? It was impossible to do more than guess now. So the whole story about how hard things were for Clara, that was just rubbish? Your mother was terribly unhappy, Beryl. Green Hills was in shambles then. It took every drop of energy Clut could give it. I think that's why she latched onto Kirkpatrick. Perhaps she saw him as her only way out. But she had responsibilities, I spat. She should have been thinking of us, too. Me, I meant, for Dickie had been fine. He had been chosen. What was this Harry like, anyway? Handsome, as I remember, and very attentive to her. She was a beautiful woman, you know. Was she? My father had managed to hide or throw out every likeness, every last reminder, particularly once Emma came along. He had rooted Clara out of our lives so well, she might never have been there at all. And I saw why. She'd gone off with another man, hurting and embarrassing him, very much as I had done with Jock. But for us, there were no children to think of. Why couldn't he have told me the truth? Your father did what he thought was best. Sometimes it's difficult to know what that is. I swallowed back rising tears, hating the fact that my mother could make me cry, that she still could, after all these years. But my feelings wouldn't be tamped down. They flooded over me, so far past my control that I had to wonder if I'd only imagined surviving Clara's leaving when I was a girl. What if the strength and invincibility I'd felt then, feats of daring, leopard hunts, and rides over the savannah on Pegasus, my ears roaring with speed and sharp freedom, were only the thinnest layer of straw over a gaping hole. Either way, I felt bottomless now. Am I really supposed to be nice, and to show her around, as if nothing, whatever, has happened? Oh, Beryl, I don't know what to tell you. She has her faults like the rest of us, I suppose. He came over and clamped my shoulders with work-reddened hands. You'll do what's right for you. If Dee felt certain that I'd make my way towards clarity, I had my doubts. Clara's telegram continued to sting, wrenching me back through time. It was so strange to be learning only now why she had left the colony, the crux of the story buried for decades. And though it didn't surprise me that my father had hidden the truth and his feelings and forged ahead with life on the farm, I couldn't stop wishing he had told me. She'd left me, too, after all. Her going had changed everything, and now she was returning? It didn't make sense. Why would she think she could find her feet in Kenya, a place she couldn't get away from quickly enough? And how had she summoned the nerve to ask for my help? How was this any of my responsibility? Angry and baffled, I was more than tempted to tell Clara to find her own way around. But she wasn't the only one I had to consider. She hadn't mentioned Dickie in her cable, though her casual reference to the boys meant she and the captain had had children together. Now those boys were fatherless, and about to be dragged into an utterly foreign world. What would they think about that? As I struggled with Clara's plea, Dennis suddenly came to mind. He had mentioned the Baroness's land and empty house less than a week ago. He'd meant it for me, for a friendly visit, but I couldn't help but be struck by the opportunity and the perfect sense of timing. Though I still hadn't entirely sorted out that I wanted to help Clara, her need and this solution seemed mysteriously matched up and sorted out already, as if the whole situation had been on its way for years and years, as if we were all being drawn together by unseen hands. It nearly felt inevitable. I told Boy and Dee that I would be away for a few days, and went to saddle Pegasus, feeling better than I had in some while. I still didn't have the slightest idea of what it would mean to have Clara back in the colony and in my life. But I was on my way to see Dennis again, and perhaps tell him a story. It was a warm afternoon. I was on a strong and beautiful horse. And I had a plan. Chapter 24. Karen Blixen's farm lay 12 miles west of Nairobi, along a rutted road that climbed steadily. The altitude was thousands of feet higher than Delamere's or Jock's, and the climbing forest cut sharp ridges into the pale sky. A long valley swung to one side of the road, strung through with carpets of orange lilies, the kind that grew up wild everywhere after it rained. The air was sweet with them, and also the white flowering coffee plants, which smelled like jasmine. Everything seemed to sparkle, just like champagne. Dennis had been right about that. Though I was fairly sure the Baroness would at least consider letting the house to my mother, it was sitting empty after all. I felt a twinge or two about coming unannounced. Settlers were spread out so widely in Kenya that visitors were generally welcomed however and whenever they popped up. But I didn't know if Dennis had yet mentioned me to her, or what their relationship was exactly. My curiosity had been simmering about them both, and I felt a sense of anticipation, of being on the verge of something interesting. The substantial bungalow was built of grey stone, with a pitched and tiled roof and sturdy-looking gables. A long porch swept all the way around the house, as did a wide, groomed lawn. Two large deerhounds sunned in the grass as I rode up, blue-grey and whiskered, with lovely pointed muzzles. They didn't bark or seem troubled by me, so I dismounted and let them have my hands to smell. I looked up as a woman came out of the house. She wore a simple white house dress and was slenderly built, with very fair skin and dark hair. Her face was most striking for its angles, and for her eyes, deep-set under feathery brows. Her gaze and her sharp, fine nose gave her the look of a pretty hawk. I felt myself squirm, suddenly embarrassed. "I'm sorry, I should have wired you," I said, giving her my name. "Is Dennis around?" "He's out on safari, actually. I don't expect him for at least a month." "A month?" But before I could feel deflated or more awkward about where to begin, she went on to say that Dennis had spoken of me, and that she'd been keen for some company. "I haven't spoken to anyone but the dogs for days, it seems." She smiled and her features softened. "I've just got some new records for my phonograph, too. Do you like music?" "I do, though I'm not very educated about it." "I'm trying to learn more myself. My friends tell me my taste is too old-fashioned." She pulled a small face and sighed. "Let's see to your horse, then." Karen's house reminded me of my childhood visits to Lady D at Equator Ranch. It was the quality of her things, the civility in the smallest details. Inside the broad front door, richly colored carpets ran over the mahogany parquet, connecting the rooms and warming them. There were silky wood tables, plump, chintz-covered sofas, and overstuffed chairs, thick draperies at every window, flowers in vases and flowers in bowls. She had shelves and shelves of finely bound books. As I looked at them, I felt very aware of my spotty education. I ran my hand along a row of their spines. My fingertips came away with no dust. "Have you really read them all?" I asked. "Of course. They've saved my life many times over. Nights can drip like molasses here, especially when good friends have gone away." I wondered if she meant Dennis, but she didn't elaborate. Instead, she showed me to a small guest room so I could wash, and then we met again on the veranda for tea. Her houseboy, Juma, held the china pot and poured for us, white gloves flapping around his thin black wrists. He passed a plate of biscuits and sweets with a formality I hadn't seen in many servants, not in these parts.
"I've come to ask a favor," I told her when Juma had gone. "But maybe you've already guessed that."
"You've come to stay then?"
Her accent rolled and swooped. Her dark eyes were pretty, but I found myself squirming under them a bit. She seemed to watch, rather than simply look at things.
"Not exactly. My mother is returning to Kenya after many years away. I thought your house might do if it's still empty. She'll pay you a fair price, of course."
"Why, yes. There hasn't been anyone in it for so long. It will be nice to have her here, and for you, too."
"She's not actually..." I had no idea how to explain it all. "We don't know each other that well."
"I see."
Again, her dark eyes fixed on me, making me want to fidget in my chair.
"It's very kind of you to help her in that case."
"I suppose so," I said, not wanting to say more. Above her house, on the ridge, 5 deeply blue hills cut a rising and falling line. They drew my eye back and forth.
"Aren't they wonderful?"
Karen said. "I love them indecently." She held up her fist to model how the shape of the ridge was like the knuckles of her hand.
"There's nothing like them in Denmark. Nothing like any of what I have here."
She drew a slim silver case from her pocket and lit a cigarette, shaking out the match and plucking a thread of tobacco from her tongue, all without taking her eyes from my face.
"Your brown skin looks so wonderful with your hair, you know," she finally said. "You really are one of the most beautiful girls I've seen in these parts.
And I read about your racing successes in the Nairobi paper. That can't be an easy life for a woman. And the society isn't terribly gentle here, is it?"
"Do you mean the gossip?"
She nodded.
"It's such a small town, Nairobi. So provincial. Which is funny considering how vast Kenya is.
You'd think we were all crouched up next to one another, whispering between windows, instead of hundreds and hundreds of miles apart."
"I hate it. Why do people hunger to know every nasty thing? Shouldn't some things be private?"
"Does it trouble you that much, what others think?"
Her face was sharply and darkly beautiful, and her deep-set onyx eyes had an intensity I hadn't seen very often. She was older than me by 10 or 15 years, I guessed, but her attractiveness was hard to ignore.
"I just feel a bit over my head sometimes. I think I was too young to get married."
"If it were another man, the right man, age might not be an issue. The rightness of the match changes everything."
"You're a romantic, then?"
"A romantic?" She smiled. "I never thought so, but lately I don't know.
I've come to think differently about love and marriage. It's not a proper philosophy.
I don't want to bore you, in any case."
She fell quiet for a moment, and a small speckled owl glided towards her from an open window on the porch, as if she'd called it silently. It settled on her shoulder.
"This is Minerva. She always turns up for company. Or maybe it's the biscuits."
Chapter 25. The name of Karen's farm was Borgani, meaning house in the woods. Out past her wide lawn, frangipani trees bloomed yellow-white and deep pink. There were palms and mimosa trees, stands of bamboo and thorn trees and banana groves. 600 acres of the lower slopes of the ridge had been groomed and tiered for bright green coffee plants. Another portion of her farm was native forest. More was rolling, fragrant grassland, and still more was home to Kikuyu Shambas, native squatters who tended cattle and goats and grew their own maize and pumpkin and sweet potato crops. We walked along a trampled footpath through shoulder-high plants and tangled vines to Bagathi, the house she would be offering Clara. It was only a small bungalow with a tiny veranda, but there were plenty of windows, and around the back stood an arbor and clustering mimosas to keep things cool. I tried to imagine my mother there, resting in the shade, but I found I couldn't conjure her at all without a shiver of anxiety. "Bro and I lived here first," Karen explained, "just after we were married. I'm still very fond of it. I met your husband once in town. He's charming."
"Isn't he?"
She smiled a complicated smile. "It's kept me from strangling him any number of times." Inside there were three small bedrooms, a kitchen, a bathroom, and a sitting room furnished with lamps and a leopard skin rug. The sofa was like a bed, squeezed into one corner, forming a cozy nook. She showed me a pretty French clock on the mantelpiece, a wedding present. Dusting the top of it with her sleeve, she said, "No doubt you've heard whispering about my marriage, as I have yours."
"Only a little."
She shook her head doubtfully.
"Ah, well, it doesn't matter. No one really knows how it is with anyone else. That's the truth. That's our only real retaliation when the gossip starts to churn."
I thought of the humiliating jokes and rumors that came with the final days of Green Hills, and how they had seemed to ruin even what had been good. Maybe that's the secret to surviving all sorts of trouble. Knowing who you are apart from it, I mean.
"Yes."
She picked up the clock, turning it over in her hand, as if to remind herself of its significance. "But like many things, it's so much easier to admire that stance than to carry it out." We left Bagathi for a tour of her factory, where dozens of Kikuyu women raked through long, narrow tables of coffee cherries that were drying in the sun, going from red to chalk white.
"This whole structure burned to the ground last January."
She plucked up a coffee cherry and rolled it between her palms until the skin split and fell away.
"One of God's little cruelties. I thought it would finish me off at the time, but here I am still."
"How do you manage? Farming is so difficult."
"Honestly, I don't know sometimes. I've risked absolutely everything, but there's everything to gain, too."
"Well, I admire your independence. I don't know many women who could do what you've done."
"Thank you. I have fought for independence here, and freedom, too. More and more I find they are not at all the same thing."
It began to rain on our way back. By the time we reached the edge of Karen's lawn, we were slick and streaming, our boots caked to the knees with red Kikuyu mud. Laughing at the sight of each other, we came around the veranda, beginning to loosen our wet things. There sat Blix, unshaven and covered with dust. He had raced ahead of the rain, apparently, and now had an uncorked bottle of brandy at his side.
"I've arrived just in time. Hello, Beryl. Hello, Tana dear,"
Karen said.
"I see you've made yourself comfortable."
"It is still my house."
"So you keep telling me."
Their teasing had a wicked edge, but under the surface there was more. Some part of whatever had stitched them together was still alive and well. That was obvious, even to me. Karen and I went in to change, and when we reappeared, Blix had settled himself more comfortably and was smoking a pipe. His tobacco smelled exotic, like something he'd found only by belly-crawling through the far reaches of the continent.
"You look well, Beryl."
"So do you. Dr. Turvey must be earning his keep."
"He's got you enlisted in that silly game."
Karen turned to Blix.
"Where have you been this time?"
"Uganda, and then back through Tanganyika with a Vanderbilt, after rhinoceros. I nearly lost him, actually."
"The Vanderbilt or the rhino?"
"That's funny, darling. The Vanderbilt.
Two lethal-looking males charge straight at him."
"The man's very lucky I had the right gun on me."
He turned to me. A rhino isn't something you want in your backyard. It's like a massive, snorting locomotive encased in unconquerable hide. When threatened, it will crash through anything, even steel. Weren't you afraid?
Not really, he smiled. I had the right gun.
If you sit at the Mutega Club long enough, Karen said, you'll hear any number of hunters making their kills again. The stories grow bigger and more harrowing with every telling. Braw is the only one I know who makes mountains into molehills, instead of the other way round.
Except for Dennis, you mean? Blix corrected.
And Dennis, yes. She didn't seem remotely flustered at hearing Dennis's name roll from her husband's lips. And Blix had said it so easily, I couldn't imagine that Dennis was Karen's lover. Still, the whole dance was fascinating. Did you see him out there? She wanted to know.
Blix shook his head.
They say he's gone west, into the Congo. What's that country like? I asked him.
Very, very dark. He sipped at his brandy. They have every kind of snake there, and some say cannibals.
Are you trying to scare me? Karen narrowed her eyes.
No, inspire you.
Tana scribbles stories all the time. Did you know, Beryl? She's quite good, actually. I'll tell you one by the fire some night.
She waved away his praise. I'm more of a storyteller than a writer, in any case.
Dennis mentioned you loved stories here.
Oh, we do, she insisted. And Braw is awfully skilled at them as well. Perhaps he'll play Scheherazade for us tonight. If I don't have to pretend to be a virgin, he said. And we all laughed.
That evening we had dinner on the veranda. The Ngong Hills went plum-colored and almost hypnotically still as Blix treated us to more tales from his Vanderbilt safari. One rolled easily into the next. He had dozens and dozens of them and didn't fall silent for more than a few minutes at a time as Karen's cook, Carmante, brought us a string of dishes. There was lightly breaded chicken in a cream sauce, roasted vegetables with herbs, a corn pudding studded with mushrooms and thyme, ripe cheese, and oranges. Blix kept our glasses filled, and by the time we reached the final course, I was floating because of the wine, and also surprised at how very much I liked these two. There wasn't anything simple about them, and I preferred that, and trusted it. My life wasn't simple either. When a hooked moon had risen into the sky, and we'd had our pudding, and our calvados, and our coffee, Blix said goodnight and began his journey back to town. "Isn't he a little too tight to be driving?" I asked her.
"I don't think he can drive any other way."
She was silent for several minutes, looking out into the dark. "He's asked me for a divorce. That's why he came." I knew from Cocky he'd asked more than once, but also that it would be cruel to let on. "Will you give him one?" She shrugged. "How would it be to have two Baronesses Blixen in the colony? There's not room, you see. One would be elbowed out and forgotten." "I can't imagine anyone forgetting you," I said. I wasn't flattering her. I truly couldn't.
"Well, we shall see.
How is it you've managed to stay friends?"
"We were friends before we were anything else. It was his younger brother Hans I was taken with. But this was long ago, in Denmark. Braw became my confidant when Hans married another."
She paused and shook her head, so that her long silver earrings tinkled. "Younger brother? He couldn't have offered you a title then?"
"No, only love."
She smiled darkly.
"But it wasn't to be. And then Braw thought of this, a new start in Africa. If only it hadn't brought a mountain of debt."
"Do you still love him?"
"I wish I could say no. But Africa sets you up to feel things you're not prepared for. I came to believe we could have everything,
children, devotion, fidelity. She shut her eyes and opened them again, the pupils flaring black. Maybe he's not capable of loving just one woman. Or perhaps he is, but not me. He was never faithful, not even in the beginning. And that's what I keep coming back to. How I thought I knew what I had bargained for when I married Bro, when actually, I had very little idea of any of it. I took a bolstering swallow of Calvados. You could be talking about my marriage. That's just how I feel. And will you get your divorce, do you think? I hope so. I'm afraid to apply any pressure just now. We are all of us afraid of many things. But if you make yourself smaller or let your fear confine you, then you really aren't your own person at all, are you? The real question is whether or not you will risk what it takes to be happy. She was referring to Jock, but her words made me think of other things, too. Are you happy, Karen? Not yet, but I mean to be.
Chapter 26. Through a series of telegrams, everything was settled with Clara very quickly. The house was going to be perfect, she insisted, and fell over herself to thank me. But even this much intimacy felt confusing. I hadn't had a mother for more than 16 years, and didn't have the slightest idea how to behave with her, even on paper. I struggled with every line, wondering how affectionate I should be, or how aloof. I had no practice with any of this. There wasn't even a word for what we were now, not mother and daughter, but not utterly estranged. It was bewildering. In one message from Clara, I learned that my brother Dickie had been in Kenya for many years and was currently up north, in Eldoret, jockeying for a good stable there. I couldn't quite believe it. Dickie had been here, in my world, without my being aware of it? What did it mean? Would we all somehow come to know one another as a family again? Did I want that? Was it even possible? I was still tumbling with conflicting feelings when Clara arrived at the tail end of May. As I set off to meet her at the Norfolk Hotel in a motor car I'd borrowed from Dee, my hands shook and my throat felt full of knots. Sweat sprang up under my arms and behind my knees like a bout of mysterious fever. It was all I could do not to run for cover when she and the boys came down and met me in the tea room. I had tried to remember what she looked like, wondering if I'd even recognize her. But I needn't have. We had the same face, with identical high cheekbones and foreheads, the same pale blue eyes. Looking at her gave me a strange, lurching feeling, as if I were meeting myself as a lost ghost, and I was glad the boys were there to pull me out of the sensation. They were 7 and 9, blonde and clean and combed, and shy at first. They half hid behind their mother as she took me in her arms. Unprepared, I bumped her hat with my elbow and pulled away, feeling stung and confused. I didn't want her embrace, but just what did I want? How was the voyage? I managed.
The waves were bigger than anything, Ivan, the older one, said. Ivan was sick all over the side of the boat, Alex broke in proudly. Twice.
It was a trial, Clara confirmed, but we're here now. We moved to a narrow table where the boys fell on plates of biscuits as if they'd been caged.
You really are too beautiful, Clara exclaimed. And married now, I understand.
I didn't know how to answer her, and so only nodded.
Harry was the joy of my life.
Clara's mouth trembled, her eyes silvered with tears.
You have no idea how hard it's been, with the debts and the uncertainty. And now I'm alone again.
As she dabbed at her tears with a handkerchief, I stared at her, feeling slightly stunned. For some reason, I thought she might try to explain herself or apologize. that she might ask regretfully about Klot, or want to know how things had really been for me. But she was very much caught up in her own sad story, this recent one, as if there weren't any other. "Bagathi is beautiful," I said, making an effort to plunge ahead. "The boys will love it there. They can run around to their heart's content, and maybe even go to school. The Baroness has found a teacher for the Kikuyu children on her land." "You really have been my savior, Beryl. I knew I could count on you." She sniffed loudly. "Isn't your sister marvelous, boys?" I was their sister, and also a stranger, a fact that didn't seem to rattle them as much as it did me. Ivan ignored Clara completely. Alex glanced up with his lips covered in biscuit crumbs, and then dived back in. 2 hours later, I drove them away from the hotel, the boys spitting over the open sides of the borrowed car into the dust. Clara chided them distractedly, and then said, "I just can't get over how much Nairobi has changed. It's a proper town now. You should have seen it back then." "Well, you've been gone a long time. In those days you couldn't walk for the goats, a postal office no bigger than a can of beans, no proper shops, no one to talk to." She swatted at the still spitting boys with her handkerchief and turned around. "I just can't get over it." She didn't seem embarrassed to be speaking of the past with me. She didn't seem to remember I was part of her past in the colony, in fact. Though maybe that was best, when I thought about it, if we could treat each other more impartially, as if there were nothing to apologize or make amends for, as if nothing had been lost. Then perhaps there might not be any further pain ahead. I hoped not as I squeezed the steering wheel with my gloved hands, pointing us out of town on the rutted road and towards Borgarni. It had been more than a month since my last visit to Karen's. I went to the main house first. Karen was up the slope at the factory, but heard the motor and came running, her hair windblown, a fingerprint of coffee dust on her cheek. There was no sign of Dennis anywhere. Perhaps he was away still, or again. "I'm sorry I look a fright." Karen extended her hand to Clara. "Today we're busy with the harvest." "Beryl explained all you do here on the ride out. I admire what you've taken on, and your house and lawn are so beautiful." Clara swept around in an appreciative circle. "You'll want some tea, or sandwiches." The boys perked up at the mention of more food, but Clara shushed them. "We've had our tea." "I'll ride out to the house with you then. Let me just change my shoes." We motored along the winding road to Bagathi, while the sweet-smelling trees pushed in at us through the windows of the car.
"Oh, it's quaint," Clara said when we arrived. "We'll be very snug here."
"You'll be staying for a while too, Beryl?" Karen asked. "I hadn't thought." I stalled, wondering how comfortable I'd be. Clara was a stranger, and a complicated one at that.
"But of course you must. We haven't caught up properly."
Clara turned to the boys, who were already down in the dust watching a Hercules beetle towering forward with a twig in its stag-like pincers.
"Tell her we need her."
"Yes," Ivan said.
Alex grunted, never taking his eyes from the beetle.
"It's settled, then."
Karen lent us her cook and her houseboy, and left my mother with the names of several Kikuyu totos, who would be there the next day ready to work if Clara would have them. When she left, Clara said, "I wouldn't have whispered a word while the Baroness was here, but the house is a little simple, isn't it?"
"I suppose so. No one's lived here for a while."
"It's much smaller than I imagined."
"There are 3 bedrooms, and you are 3.
"Not for tonight," she clarified. "But I can sleep anywhere. I'm not fussy."
"That's a wonderful skill, Beryl. You always were the toughest of us."
I flinched involuntarily and rearranged myself in my chair.
"Dickie's been jockeying," he said.
Yes, and very good at it. Do you remember how he could ride?
I nodded vaguely.
I know he'd want to be here now, but he hasn't been feeling well. He never had a strong constitution, as you know.
I remembered so little. Skinned knees when the farm was raw and full of obstacles. Him kicking me once hard in my side as we fought over a toy. But even that was too much, in a way. It would have been simpler to have forgotten every last stitch.
He's going to send money as soon as he can, naturally, she went on, her eyes beginning to well up again. Forgive a silly woman, Beryl. Forgive me.
That night I tossed and turned on the sofa near the hearth, feeling unsettled by Clara. Her strange combination of neediness and amnesia. I found myself wishing that I hadn't answered her first telegram, or that she hadn't thought to send it. But we were here now, stuck in a curious limbo. Some time past midnight, long after the fire had died away, it began to rain. I heard the pattering getting louder, and then Clara appeared, kneeling at my side. She wore a nightgown and robe, and held a guttering candle. Her feet were bare, and her hair tumbled down her back, making her look very young.
It's pouring. Try to ignore it. We get lots of rain at this time of year.
No, I mean inside. She dragged me to one of the smaller rooms, where the boys were huddled together in one bed, while a seam in the roofline dripped water down on the blankets. The water was coming straight at them, but they barely had the sense to get out of the way.
Let's move the bed, I suggested.
Right, Clara said. She never would have thought of it on her own. That was clear. The boys clambered down, and Clara and I pushed the bed to the other wall.
It's wet here too.
The second bedroom was a bit drier. We found buckets in the kitchen and moved them around, catching the drips, then went from room to room, trying to find the safest place for the furniture.
It's hopeless, Clara said, throwing up her hands.
Only a little rain, I sighed. You boys don't mind, do you? But they seemed just as fragile suddenly. Alex had a rumpled bear, a teddy bear, after Roosevelt. He tugged at its ear and looked ready to hide in a cupboard.
We'll just have to get through the night, I suggested. Tomorrow we'll see if workers can repair the roof.
I think it's driest here, my mother said of the couch. Do you mind if the boys and I have your place?
Not at all, I sighed again.
Thank you. And it would be lovely if we could have a fire, wouldn't it, boys? The wood was damp and smoked, and took a real effort to get going. When I finally did, I was too exhausted to move the beds again. I fell into the first one I came to, and curled up in the damp sheets, and tried to sleep. It rained buckets all the next day. By mid-afternoon, Clara was at her wit's end. Karen had come to try and make things suitable, but the downpour wouldn't stop, and the rain got through everywhere. Finally, she moved Clara and the boys into the main house.
I really am sorry for your trouble, Karen said again and again.
It's not your fault, Clara assured her, gathering damp bits of her hair into hairpins. But something in her tone told me she did hold Karen responsible, or perhaps me instead. I suppose it wasn't a great surprise to see she had very little gumption or resilience, and yet it made me sad for her. How dreadful it would be if everything toppled you, and you folded in. Rain, for instance, not to mention the loss of a husband. She was so pitiful, I shouldn't have been irritated with her, but I couldn't help it. By dinner time, I was too fed up with the whole situation and bolted for Soy Sambu and my horses, for work, which was never mysterious, and never failed to soothe me.
"I'll be back at the weekend," I said, and rode off in Dee's motor car through thick and spattering red mud.
Chapter 27. By the time I arrived at Bogani 3 days later, Clara had already bolted. She'd hired a car to come and take her and the boys back to Nairobi, leaving only a brief note to apologize for the inconvenience.
I did take care to get the house cleaned up and ready for them, Karen said. Rain is rain. What could I have done?
I hope she left you some money at least.
Not a rupee.
I was horribly embarrassed.
Let me pay you something. Don't be silly. It's not your doing. You can stay and cheer me up, though. I've been lonely.
Late that night, the rain began again. This could happen in May, and often did. Seismic, drenching storms that went on and on, turning the roads into gullies, and gullies into impassable torrents.
You can't go back in this, Karen said the next morning, looking out through the open veranda at the streaming grey sheets.
Dee will be wondering about me. I may have to risk it.
He's a reasonable man.
Occasionally, anyway. You can't very well swim home.
Before we'd finished talking, a young Somali boy ran up to the house, nearly naked, with red mud splattered up to his slender hips.
Beda is on his way, the boy announced. He will be here soon.
Beda was Dennis, obviously. I could read on Karen's face how happy the news made her as she brought the boy inside and insisted he bathe and change and eat something hearty before returning.
Dennis's servants are utterly devoted to him, she told me as she dabbed with a cotton cloth at the wet footprints the boy had left on her tiles.
There were servants everywhere, but clearly she liked to work with her hands and to be useful.
They respect him as if he were one of them.
I think they'd lie down in a lion's mouth if he asked them.
I felt her guard lowering a little and inched my way closer.
How did you become friends?
At a shoot we threw several years ago. He arrived with Delamere and then came down with a terrible fever and had to stay. I had about given up on finding anything like good company here, but then there he was.
She looked up from her work.
Honestly, I've never met such an intelligent person before. It was the loveliest surprise of that whole year.
Even with a fever?
Yes, even so. She smiled. But then I went away home, and after that he did. And it's only lately that we're back to our friendship, you see. I feel very fortunate.
She stood up and wiped her hands on her apron. Beyond the open door, the sky was thick and low, and the rain went on and on.
I'll have one of the boys fetch your horse, if you like, unless you'll reconsider.
I thought of the slick miles to Soy Sambu, and then of Dennis's hazel eyes and his laughter. I wanted to see him again, and also to know how he and Karen were together.
I may have to, I told her. It's not going to stop.
All that day, Karen stayed focused on Dennis's imminent arrival, dreaming up dinner menus and getting her servants to polish the house from top to bottom. Finally, Dennis's Somali boy came running into sight again, and Dennis himself followed not long after, wet to the skin, but somehow cheerful. He rode up, unflappably, while his equally undaunted Somali man, Bilea, walked.
It's a little embarrassing to be held up by rain when you've managed quite well, I confessed, after we'd said our hellos.
I haven't told you about the bits where my horse was up to his neck.
He squinted at me, and then took off his hat, water pouring from the brim.
Besides, it's nice to see you.
Karen whisked him away deep into the house to get comfortable before dinner, while I took myself into the library, suddenly nervous. I wasn't sure why, but as I tried to page through a pile of Thackeray novels and travel books Karen had set aside for me, I found myself reading the same snatches over and over again, holding on to nothing, while from her perch nearby, the little owl Minerva swiveled her head and looked at me with great, round, unblinking eyes. She was the size of a feathered apple, with a glossy beak, like the tip of a buttonhook. I went over to her and tried to show her I was a friend, petting her with one finger as Karen had done. And finally she seemed convinced. Maybe my feelings were only bald insecurity, I thought, looking again at the thick stack of books. Dennis and Karen were each so intelligent, and together they might make me feel a fool. Would it have killed me to stay at school for a few years and glean some knowledge that had nothing to do with horses or farming or hunting with Kabee? I had been so anxious to be back at home, thrusting myself at what I knew, that I couldn't imagine any part of book learning that might be useful. Now it was probably too late. I could try to soak up a few tidbits from the Thackeray and possibly sound clever at dinner. But that would be acting a part, trying to be some version of Karen. Stupid, I said, irritated with myself, while Minerva stretched out one striped yellow claw. For better or worse, I was who I was. It would have to do. Dennis was starved for talk after so many weeks in the bush. During the meal of scented tomato water, blanched tiny lettuces, and turbot in a hollandaise that melted on the spoon, he told us how he'd come back through the North Country. Near Eldoret, he'd stopped at some property he owned, and had seen and heard evidence of tourists hunting wild game from their motor cars and leaving the carcasses to rot. My God! I had never heard of such a thing. It's slaughter.
I blame Teddy Roosevelt, he said. Those photographs of him straddling slain elephants like some sort of buccaneer. It came off too glamorous, too easy.
I thought his hunting was a scheme to collect specimens for museums, Karen said.
Don't let the museum piece fool you. He was a sportsman through and through.
Dennis pushed his chair back from the table and lit a cigar. It's not Roosevelt that gets to me so much as what he started. These animals shouldn't die for nothing, because someone gets drunk and loads a rifle.
Perhaps there could be a law one day, Karen said.
Perhaps. But in the meantime, I hope I don't run into one of these joyriders, or I won't be responsible for my actions.
You're trying to hold on to paradise. Karen's eyes simmered in the candlelight, intense and deeply black. Dennis remembers too well how unspoiled things were in the early days, she told me. So do I. It's hard to forget.
Beryl's mother was here for a short time, Karen explained to Dennis, and then said, I thought she was going to be a tenant at Bagathi.
Oh, he said, I assumed your mother had died.
It's all right. You wouldn't be very far off. She went away when I was very young. I couldn't survive without my mother's love, Karen said. I write to her every week on Sunday and live for the letters she sends. This week, I'll tell her about you and say you look like the Mona Lisa. Would you ever let me paint you? You'd make a wonderful picture, just as you are now. Lovely. And also a little lost.
I flushed at her description, feeling pride at. She spoke so frankly, but it was her eyes, too, and how nothing seemed to escape her.
Those things don't really show on my face, do they?
I'm sorry, try not to mind me.
People interest me so much. They're such wonderful puzzles. Think of it. Half the time we've no idea what we're doing. But we live anyway.
Yes, Dennis said. Searching out something important and going astray look exactly the same for a while, in fact.
He stretched and resettled himself like a rangy tomcat in the sun.
Sometimes no one knows the difference, especially not the poor damned pilgrim.
He winked at me almost imperceptibly.
Now, how about a story? No supper without a tale.
I'd been thinking of what I might tell them, and had finally settled on Paddy and that day at the Elkingtons' farm. Wanting to hold their attention, I described everything I remembered from the beginning, and slowly, the ride out to Kobete Station and my father's speech about lions, Bichon Singh and his endless turban, the gooseberry bushes, and the sizzling crack of Jim Elkington's kiboko. After a while, I forgot that I was trying to draw Dennis and Karen in, and became engrossed myself,
almost as if I'd forgotten what was going to happen and how it all turned out.
"Hugh must have been absolutely terrified," Karen said when I'd finished. "I can't think many have lived through such a thing."
"I was, yes. But later I came to see it as a kind of initiation."
"I'll bet it was important for you. We all have those moments, though not always so dramatic."
Dennis paused, looking into the fire.
"They're meant to test us, and change us, I think. To make plain what it means to risk everything."
The room grew quiet for a time. I thought of what Dennis had said, and watched the two of them smoke in silence. Finally, Dennis pulled a pocket-sized volume from inside his brown velvet jacket.
"I found a small gem in a bookshop when I was in London. It's called Leaves of Grass."
He opened to a dog-eared page and held it out to me, saying I should read for us.
"God, no. I'll butcher it."
"You won't. I thought of this one particularly for you."
I shook my head.
"You do it, Dennis," Karen said, saving me. "In Beryl's honor."
"I think I could turn and live with animals," he read aloud. "They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them, long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins." He recited the words simply, not at all theatrically, but they had their own gravity and drama. The poem seemed to be about how naturally dignified animals are, and how their lives make more sense than those of humans, which are cluttered with greed and self-pity, and talk of a distant god. It was something I'd always believed. He finished with this passage. "A gigantic beauty of a stallion, fresh and responsive to my caresses. Head high in the forehead, wide between the ears, limbs glossy and supple, tail dusting the ground, eyes full of sparkling wickedness, ears finely cut, flexibly moving."
"It's wonderful," I said quietly. "May I borrow it?"
"Of course." He handed the little volume to me, light as a feather and still warm from his holding it. I said good night and went off to my room, perching under a lamp to read over more of the poems. The house grew still around me. But after a while it occurred to me that I was hearing sounds coming from down the hall. Borghani wasn't all that large, and the noises, though muffled, were unmistakable. Dennis and Karen were making love. I closed the book in my hands, feeling a small surge of adrenaline. I'd been so certain they were only close friends. Why had I thought that? Blix had said Dennis's name so lightly that night he'd come here, but perhaps that only meant he'd come to accept Dennis's place in Karen's life. In fact, the more I thought about it, the more obvious it seemed that these two would be drawn together. They were both beautiful and interesting, full of deep water, as the Kips would say. And no matter what Barclay had said about Dennis being elusive in love, he and Karen had an obvious bond. I could see that clearly. I turned to the book again, leafing through to the animal poem Dennis had recited for me. But the black type jumped. Beyond several walls, the lovers were whispering things to each other, their bodies blending with shadows, coming together and apart. Their affair had nothing to do with me, and yet I couldn't stop thinking of them. Finally, I turned out the lamp and pulled the pillow up around my ears, wanting only to go to sleep. The next day the clouds parted, and the sky went a deep, fresh blue. And we went out on a small shooting expedition. Ostriches had got into the garden and plucked through most of the baby lettuces. There were dung and feathers everywhere, as the birds lurched through the patch, taking what they wanted. Both Dennis and Karen looked well-rested and happy,
when I had slept unpleasantly. Still, tired as I was, and slightly embarrassed by what I had learned the night before, Dennis's confidence and ease impressed me, as they always seemed to.